All right, so this is a project in the best spirit of Berkman Distributed Collaborative work. Lots of people have been laboring on this venture. Bill has been leading it, and in his absence, Jackie's been leading it, but several of the people in the room here have contributed wonderful stuff, and their various contributions will be noted as we go along. And with that tiny introduction, let you two guys outline what's been going on and solicit reaction.
Okay. So in the tradition of these lunches, what we'll do in the next few minutes is try and give you a window into what we've been working on and then solicit some feedback, and you can then all tell us why, despite the time we've spent on it, we've missed something or overlooked something or should think about something a little differently, and we hope you will, because that's really, for us, the benefit of having all of these smart people gathered in a room and also out there in cyberspace, in Second Life and other places to hear what we've been up to. So the project is about the not just copyright law, but also the attendant structures, market structures, and sort of normative behaviors that grow up in the shadow of copyright law, and how they affect the use of content in educational activity. And we've sort of had this slightly corny tag phrase of digital learning, trying to encompass everything we mean by education. I mean, partly we mean what is happening in traditional classrooms, that digital technology moves you beyond merely a teacher in the front of the room lecturing at a passive class, and it allows for more multimedia tools in teaching, and allows for students to work with multimedia content. You know, a book report now need not be merely a five-page, paragraph written document. And then, of course, lots of teachers, particularly at the university level, are engaging in collaborative technology such as class wikis and blogs. And all of those things are transforming what happens even in the traditional classroom. But we also mean to move beyond that more familiar setting, and it almost goes on a spectrum. I mean, so you have, as I say here, opening the classroom to the world is a part of it, and I'll point you to this website, which is Derek Bambauer and Tim Armstrong's class that they're teaching at the Harvard Extension School. And as you can see, the syllabus is here online, and so, in fact, are most of the readings. And, for example, here's a important piece written by an important person in this space, Yochai Benkler, and you can read it. So
wait, a copyright violation.
Indeed. The MIT has taken this general principle and moved it to a whole different level by developing their open courseware project, which puts many, many classes on the MIT campus to different extents online. Some of them merely have the syllabus online, but others do something similar to what Derek and Tim have done and put lots of content up as well. So you see that, and H2O playlists here at the Berkman Center are another example of taking traditional teaching and moving that out into the wider world. And then you also have learning sites that are not even tied to traditional locations. I'll just give you one of my favorite examples. We had a workshop last fall with a bunch of people involved in this activity gathered, and one of them gave us this example. It's called the Red Hot Jazz Archive at redhotjazz.com. And so here's the page on Louis Armstrong and his stompers. There's sound clips. There's links to essays about these people and all the band members. And then just to give you a sense of the quantity of information that's on here, this is the A's, B's. It goes down, the C's, this list is vast. It's a huge archive of materials. So if you're interested in 20th century and late 19th century jazz, it becomes a great site for you to learn a lot. And then moving on the spectrum even further away from the traditional classroom, you have what you might think of as open source education, Wikipedia being the most obvious example. Someone else also at our November workshop was involved in the Samuel Pepys Diary, which is a... that every day they post a page from the famous 17th century diary, and then people annotate it with all kinds of information about the history, the culture, the references that Pepys is making. So all of these things are encompassed in what we think of as education, It's no longer just what's happening in institutions and classrooms. And then I would also mention that not just the teaching, but the scholarship becomes transformed by digital technology. You know, it's faster, you have access to so much more material, you have tools to be collaborative in scholarship. So it's all very exciting. But, and the but is where our analysis really comes in, because there are problems with taking advantage of all of these wonderful digital innovations. We have some case studies at the beginning of our paper. I'll just sort of say what they are, because they're really just examples of things that people are trying to do that have been in some ways obstructed. So one of the case studies is the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, and Genevieve Marker, who's in the room, worked on this case study for us. They wanted to have social networking for teachers and the ability for them to share classroom resources. You know, some of these PowerPoint slides that teachers put up, if one teacher develops a great one, they should perhaps be able to share it with others. And various exceptions in copyright law let a teacher show a PowerPoint slide with copyrighted material in it, but probably not distributed to other teachers. So the Center for History and New Media has had to constrain the kinds of resources teachers are able to share. Even resources teachers are able to show in the classroom, they're not allowed to distribute through digital technology. Jackie Harlow here worked on a case study about film studies teachers trying to use DVD, but they can't crack the DRM technology, and they're not allowed to circumvent it under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So they can't even do a clip reel to show their class, you know, three different clips from three different directors who use, you know, light and shadow in a certain way. There's the Database of Recorded American Music, which was a project, again, Genevieve Merker worked on this case study for us, and it's New World Records, a small, academically oriented music label, wanted to digitize and distribute to universities its music, but the licensing difficulties they had and the DRM that they had to put on the music led to lots of problems. And then finally, WGBH here in Boston is the largest producer of content for public television in the United States, and they are trying to move some of their content beyond traditional broadcast into fields like webcasting, and they're finding that the law is not allowing them to do that for various reasons, because the special exceptions that apply to public broadcasting are technologically bound. They're only applied to broadcast, not to new technology, and it leads to trouble. Jay Fialco, who's at the table, spends many sleepless nights worrying about these things. He works at WGBH. So out of these case studies, we came up with four categories of problems, and I'll run through them quickly. One is just the law itself. It's unfavorable or unclear. The second is the rising specter of what some people call DRM, strict technological copying limitations that cause problems. The third type of problem is just that if you do need to clear rights, it's not that easy to do, and it's very expensive, and you may never be able to find the rights holder. And then these three things lead to a fourth problem. Institutions you'd think would care about digital learning, like universities and school districts, are very cautious because they're cowed by the legal and technical difficulties they face. I'm not going to give you all the details on the legal problems because they're detailed, and we can talk about them more if people have questions, but you know, fair use is notoriously difficult to apply, and although educational use is supposed to get special treatment, that isn't always how it works out when these cases get litigated. Congress made an attempt called the Teach Act a while back that was supposed to allow new technology for distance learning to flourish, but the experts we've consulted out in the field say basically it's useless because there's so many requirements attached to it. Then there's these exceptions in copyright law that are tied to yesterday's technology, like the public broadcasting example. And then, of course, there's the fact that there's these big damages at the end. So educators are scared of the prospect of huge legal fees and huge awards arising out of, you know, them just trying to bring content into education. The second set of problems that I said is tied to DRM, and I'm going to pass to Jackie, who's our resident DRM expert, to study this.
So DRM is, as most people know here, is a way that content owners or content producers use to technology to protect their goods. So they can use these DRM systems that involve encryption or watermarking or other techniques for limiting exactly how users can access and make use of their works. What's interesting is that while we often think of DRM just in the context of commercial content providers locking down their materials, such as film studios locking down DVDs with CSS encryption, educators sometimes also use these tools. So the paper looks at both aspects of this. In particular, we look at content owners locking down content. And again, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act gives content owners sort of unprecedented power to use technology to eliminate things like the fair use exemption for educational use of digital works. In addition, there are incentives, mostly economic, that encourage commercial content providers to lock down their works. The speed bumps approach to DRM, talked about at length by Charlie Nesson and others here at the Berkman Center, talks about how DRM can be used to sort of try to race against the hackers to keep most people purchasing works legitimately instead of stealing them or hacking through DRM. And also there's a limited incentive for content owners to create educationally useful works. So for example, the market for DVDs to be used by film studies professors would be relatively small and not particularly lucrative for content owners, and yet prevent a huge risk of leakage if that content, that unlocked content, got out into the mainstream and then sort of took away market share from commercial use. On the flip side, the less commonly talked about issue is that educators and schools actually lock content in. There are numerous reasons for this. A big one is just inadvertent or default lock-in. Schools, for example, that use course management tools like Blackboard to allow professors to post content online are locking that content in, because that content, even if it's set to the least restrictive protection measures, is still restricted to people authorized to use the Blackboard course management tool or other similar tools. In addition, you have the intentional protection of IP. Universities and lower-level schools put a lot of resources into creating an infrastructure for transferring technology and into having professors and students create content. So in some cases, they actually see a reason to regulate who uses their content and how that content is used. Although there's been a big academic movement away from that sort of attitude, there are still reasons professors and universities want to lock their content in, such as to protect its integrity, to protect its authenticity. Finally, as Bill mentioned before, you have universities or educators who are simply scared. They're scared that fair use won't protect them. They don't understand the bounds of the law, and so they act as cautiously as possible and lock their content in. So digital rights management technologies present huge problems for those wishing to use content educationally and to share content across institutional borders.
So we've seen the legal problems and then the problems that are caused by this technology supported by law through the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The third problem is really more of a market problem. If anyone notices that this is starting to match the Larry Lessig typology of law, norms, market, and code, then it just means Lessig is smart. We didn't do it on purpose, but it turns out they do actually end up breaking up that way. So in some situations, legitimately, fair use might not apply to the particular way an educator is going to use content, and so they ought to go get a license and clear the rights from the rights holder. But it's not as easy as that simple sentence makes it sound. First of all, they have to determine if a license is necessary, which in large institutions is a difficult proposition. They have to do the legal analysis around fair use, and they also have to go look at their library's deal with the content holder. And some of those are very complicated and allow for certain kinds of uses and not others, so it's a big personnel-intensive operation. Then they have to find who they're supposed to pay, which isn't always easy, particularly with obscure or older content. Academic content may be of principally historical interest, and you run into the so-called orphan works problem of a work that may be under copyright, but you can't really figure out who controls that copyright so that you could get a license if you wanted it. If you can do those two things, Then you have to pay, and often you have to pay a great deal, and sometimes the, we're talking about nonprofit educational institutions in a lot of cases. And then there are also other conditions that come with these licenses, some of which are burdensome and cut counter to the educational mission, like, as Jackie pointed out, you know, you can have this, but only if you lock it down in ways that, excessively restrict access to the content. There's also this conundrum, which I'll just pass over briefly, that the more the easier it is to have clearance, and the more it becomes the accepted course to get clearance, the less likely you are to be able to prevail on a fair use defense for the same kind of material. Because people say, the courts say, well, look, you can get a license, and that's what other people do, so you should too. When they analyze the market effect, they tend to then look less kindly on a fair use defense in the same situation. So the fourth sort of problem really stems from the first three. I say here that key intermediaries are often ignorant, greedy, or chicken. And that pretty much sums it up. Often out of good intentions, sometimes out of less good ones, you have large institutions that have a lot of say in how educators can use content. Their editors at the publishing and distribution houses that get their work out to the public, the universities and schools where they work, insurers, E&O insurers, and most of these places have very cautious or conservative policies about how content should be used and how aggressively fair use ought to be asserted. And educators often don't know enough to know that those policies are more restrictive than their legal rights allow. So really, education of those people and proselytization of a new point of view is part of the solution here. So really, our project has principally been focused on diagnosis. You know, we've identified these four categories of problems, and we have talked to people about how pervasive they are, where they really interfere with the educational mission. And it should be said very clearly that one of the challenges here is that you do want, the point of copyright is to preserve the incentives to create. And, you know, everything's a balancing act. So while it might be simple to suggest that, you know, that there should be extreme openness, you have to make sure it doesn't go so far as to undermine the ability of authors, scholars, publishers, to get a fair return on the investment that they've put into creating the knowledge we're talking about here. So it gets very complicated when you start talking about reform, but we'll just briefly say a few of the things that in our white paper we're going to say, here are some paths towards reform. Here are some avenues worth pursuing. You know, one avenue, obviously enough, we're lawyers, or at least the three of us are, and so we look at legal changes pretty naturally, whether they be changes to fair use, whether they be improvements in the exceptions that now anticipate so-called, quote-unquote, face-to-face teaching, where really now in a digital and distributed environment, we might not be talking about face-to-face teaching anymore. And perhaps some other types of exceptions that the law should take seriously the mission of copyright to advance education, whether a compulsory licensing scheme, limitations on damages, exceptions for that orphan works problem I mentioned where you can't locate the rights holder. Those are the kinds of legal changes that we're discussing. This is a DRM page, so Jackie?
So again, the building off of Bill's comments on legal reforms, one of the most obvious potential reforms to fix the DRM problem would be to create an educational use exception to the DMCA. And this could be through the form of getting the Librarian of Congress to create an exception, or just outright changing the text of the anti-circumvention and anti-trafficking sections of the DMCA, which prohibit people like film professors from using DVDs in the same way that they could legally use VHS tapes. As you see, the it says, yeah, right under this. And the reason is not because...
We can dream!
Right. The reason is because the lobbying interests are so strong, and in addition, there are a great number of legal scholars, one of whom is affiliated with the clinical program here, I think, or at least used to be, who just wrote a paper that was published in one of the Columbia Law journals about why now is not the time to change the DMCA. So this is sort of a slower moving, perhaps longer term goal or potential solution. Another shorter term solution that is relatively feasible is just to educate educational users about DRM. So you can encourage institutions to adopt systems like iCommons or the H2O playlists. You can also continue to promote openness as a part of the educational mission. And finally, try to inform educators about the law. So where there are clear-cut cases regarding fair use, and help educators to differentiate between the gray area and the relatively black and white areas of the law so that they can come a little bit further in using works. Finally, take the time to converse with the other side and really work with content providers to develop educational usable content. Bill mentioned a problem with this before, though, is that it could potentially reduce the scope of fair use if we all of a sudden have all of these licensing regimes and educators become expected to license work. Nonetheless, it's important to figure out what the interests of content providers are and why they do the things they do, and see if we can find a way to create educational usable versions of content.
The third and fourth areas, clearance and the ignorant and chicken gatekeepers, really are in most ways more about, again, education. There are some overlapping legal changes that could help make clearance easier, orphan works changes, a principle among them. There's also some interesting moves towards automated clearance technology. The Copyright Clearance Center, which is an institution that functions a little bit like a mini ASCAP for a lot of printed material, although it doesn't have the same kind of reach as ASCAP in terms of the percentage of all text that it controls rights to. But they've been working hard on tools that allow you to get instant licenses. Not always on favorable terms for educators, but that certainly would ease a lot of the burden I described before. And of course, clearance will be improved as we have an increase in more open forms of distribution, such as Creative Commons and open access journals. That's not a full solution, but certainly the more content is out there, freer of copyright restrictions, the less this is going to be a problem in the future. We've done some work on that, and Nick Bramble, who's in the room, has done a lot of research on that with us, along with Mike Carroll at Villanova Law School. And then finally, changing the attitudes. The best reassurance, of course, is clearer legal principles, but there's also the ability to take matters into our own hands and unify around best practices to say, Peter Yazzie at the American University School of Law has worked with others on a statement of best practices and fair use for documentary filmmakers. And he got a lot of filmmakers together and some distributors and others and said, this is our industry-wide statement of how fair use is supposed to work. It's more elaborated than just the bare bones of the statute or the cases. And, something similar in educational space might be possible. It runs the risk of running into the same sorts of log jams that have happened in the past, but we think it might be something worth pursuing as a something less than legal reform, but reform of practices. So that's what we've been working on for the last 6 or 8 months, and in the Burtman tradition, we're going to pose two broad closing questions to the room and hope that we'll get feedback on that in addition to everything else. The one we're really interested in hearing is the first question. Is our description sound? I mean, do people feel, especially those who are involved in this space in various different ways, do people feel there are other problems we haven't identified or that there are some of the problems we've talked about inaccurately? And then second, what are we going to do about it? What about the paths to reform? And do people feel that some are more or less promising, more or less worth pursuing? Or are there other entirely new paths that we should follow? So I guess those are our questions to you. I don't know if you have anything to add, Terry. Okay. Let it rip, folks.
I think in the paths to reform, in my little brain, I see the like law being the first thing in the sense that it's, okay, we can change law. If we can't change law, what else can we do? Which is kind of how you laid it out. And I like, it would be neat to see the more of a link between the problems and the path to reform, because, for example, when Jackie was describing the attempts at educating the educators and how that would be an attempt to either lessen the great, like improve the chilling effects, lessen the chilling effects, and to have people, the inadvertent copyright protection, the locking in, those two, I'm assuming that's what the educating the educators mean, but that doesn't really help the rest of the educating problems in terms of the people who actually do want to protect their content and stuff. I like having maybe more of a link between those two, mm-hmm. in terms of these are the problems and this is the reform and this is what the reform would work towards helping, but this is the limitations and the reform still doesn't solve these other problems.
How go ahead. You had your hand up. Okay. So I work for an academic publisher, and
right.
I guess my question is it worth making a distinction between content whose original purpose is not educational, like a movie or some other thing, and content that is produced and published specifically for learning, so teaching materials or other things, and do you see a difference?
Yeah.
There's an analogous problem that arises involving the experimental use defense in patent law, where the principal opponents to an expanded, in the United States, experimental use defense are the developers of tests and so forth that are primarily aimed at facilitating experiments, research. And they're afraid that what appears to most patentees a minor encroachment upon their entitlements would be for them to destroy their markets, because that's what they most care about. So you're, in effect, I assume, by posing the question that way, asking the same form, that suggesting that educational publishers and producers should get more protection than non-educational producers vis-a-vis educational uses, because it's more of an encroachment upon their markets. So it has this the same plausibility it does in the patent context. It has the same irony, however, which is that just when you most need access to the stuff to engage in effective education, this pattern would construct the highest barriers. So there's some plausibility to it, but awkwardness to it. I don't think we have yet, in fact, I know we have not as yet, identified any clear solution. We recognize the issue, but don't have any clean solution to it yet.
And I mean, you know, part of the problem too is thinking about the types of incentives that that creators and distributors need to be able to be sure that we still get this great knowledge out there into our information ecosystem, and that becomes a very complicated calculus that's affected by just what Terry has described. You know, in some ways, educators who are producing content are doing it because that's their mission in life, because that helps them get tenure, because that's, you know, what, you know, that's a labor of love, rather than, you know, someone who's churning out commercial jingles someplace who better get paid for that task. On the other hand, of course, as Terry says, it's being used in the very settings, those very same educational settings. So it becomes very complicated to balance the question of necessary incentives with the different type of content. And one more thing, it's also not always so easy to see which box something falls into. You know, a serious literary novel could be seen in either camp.
If I can add something to that too, what's interesting, at least that I've discovered in my research, is that many times the creators of the educational materials actually are less restrictive in use than the creators of commercial materials that are more broadly used. And that makes sense, right? Because, again, something like a movie is expensive and hard to create and has a huge market, whereas something like a digital textbook might be a smaller piece of a publisher's overall economic picture. And really, its success depends on the ability of educational users to use it. So I found that there's actually less DRM used to lock down educationally oriented material.
I have a sort of structural question about how this gets set up. If you begin with the assumption intellectual property is property, and that one of the definitions of property is that you, if you have it, you have the right to exclude, then you could see both fair use and some of these technologies we're talking about. Fair use is, first of all, a sort of cobbled together exception to this property rule, and always the stepchild of it, and always under repair and chasing after them. And secondly, the things like DRM and Millennium Copyright Act, and so forth, these are the triumph of the property rule, that they finally have figured out how to actually exclude. And so then it leads me, I connect it to my own sense of the hopelessness of, first of all, educating educators. I mean, I'm at a small college in Ohio sometimes, and I would dread that early semester meeting where the lawyers lecture. I mean, it would go on forever. And also the sort of reforms, which are, again, chasing after, you know, how to make fair use better. So then I wonder, isn't there some way to work around all this, to approach it under some other frame rather than property exclusion, fair use? And there's some question that goes with that.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe Terry and Yochai Benkler should answer that question rather than, I mean, certainly, once intellectual property got established as the phrase we use to talk about this stuff, people who care about the commons lost a first important battle, because it shouldn't, I think implicit in your question is that it shouldn't necessarily be seen as property analogous to real property with quite those same levels of rights to exclude. And I think properly applied, you know, you're particularly in educational space, there are these other exceptions that are at least intended to facilitate teaching by using content. I'm thinking specifically about the classroom use exception. I think the problem is that they haven't kept pace. You know, I mean, I think actually some number of years ago, maybe 40, teachers were able to do most of what they wanted to do inside the classroom. And then as the course pack decisions happened, and now as new technology is happening, it's becoming less and less the case. So it's not that, I mean, the balance has been thrown off, but what's thrown it off is technology more than anything. I don't know if others have thoughts on that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is to some extent tied to the question that I wanted to ask, but I'm wary to move on being too much about, but here's what I wanted to ask, so let's move on. So I don't know if somebody wants to talk. Okay, let me just...
Go ahead.
One thing you didn't present, I don't know whether it's in the paper, I would probably have liked to see finer-grained breakdown of this category of educational uses, which you present a little bit in the first and second slides, but maybe you have in the report, I haven't seen it yet. So let me just hum a few bars of what it is that I'm thinking about and why it's relevant to this basic question of what the solutions are. So the first thing I think to recognize is that the K-12 problem and the collegiate and graduate program problem are two completely different problems with different production systems producing the materials, mm-hmm. different agency of the people in the market, not different from a legal perspective. But in terms of looking for solutions and potential government yes. intervention points, they're very different. So for example, K-12 is a highly regulated environment. The state tests you. You have to teach to a certain set of things. You have to have approved textbooks. In many states, it's a statewide. In some state, in many states, it's local, but nonetheless, there's local government. That does all sorts of things, both in terms of creating the problems and creating the solutions. So let's just take textbooks. Textbooks in the United States, big states that buy, that standardize and buy collectively are California, Texas, Florida, which for all practical purposes determine the content of American K-12 textbooks because of that.
Right.
This does a couple of things in terms of setting up the problem. One, it forces the use of the outputs of commercial textbook developers who are optimized to lobby these particular state, these three state capitals to get adoption, and optimize in getting the people to put them together and setting up. So it's a very closed government procurement system that's got almost nothing to do with IP, and this is not new. This is Breyer from 1970 already writing about this, and writing about this as a ripe target from which to back off a copyright system. The flip side is, then who are the players? The players are teachers, high variability in terms of training and education and ability to participate, but also millions of people, out of whom you don't need a huge percentage of people to participate in order to get a genuine peer production system of educational materials going, with the real blockage being the regulatory requirements constraining the outputs. So, points of intervention, not federal law, because I put the yeah right under all legal interventions given the political economy, not only the DMCA, but at the state procurement level. And maybe the intervention needs to be California because of the relative strength of the cultural current commitment to policy, perhaps being stronger than in Texas than in Florida today, just because of the IT industry and its particular cultural adoption. But that's a completely different approach to intervention than federal legal change. That's not one of your intervention points, even though it touches education for many people. The flip side is the content of the material in the collegiate and graduate level. I think you need to break down the problems of illustrative uses for multimedia purposes of commercially produced things is different than the relative weight of academically produced materials published through academic journals that set up the economics of collegiate and graduate educational materials as being much more similar to academic publication. At least this is a hypothesis. This is not something I've looked at, so I don't know. But this would be the hypothesis that I'd be interested to look at. Is how close are the collegiate and graduate school teaching material economics to academic journals? Because in academic journals, we really have a genuine alternative approach. It's a live political debate. We know who the players are. Hewlett Foundation is actually working not only on open journal publication, but also on open educational materials. There is a solution outside the legal system if the economics are in fact the same or not the same. Now, when I looked at textbooks in both of these domains, I came back a little more skeptical than I was going into it. But learning objects may be different. Syllabi that are individual, like the ones that you see in MIT OpenCourseWare. So I guess my overarching comment in terms of another interface into the results of your research that could be useful is to separate out at a minimum K through 12 and collegiate and graduate, characterize the particular production system of each of these, at least the mainstream, identify what the primary commercial or non-commercial flows are, and then give, and this is where I eventually tie up to the excuse of barging into your comment, where the particular interventions that can be done don't have to go through law, as I said, because my basic skepticism is that interventions through law all have the attached to them. To the right.
My response to that in general is yes. I will say, and I don't know if Genevieve is still here, but she worked on the Center for History and New Media project where high school teachers who were doing the resource sharing. And people who are out there in this space, some of them at least, you know, everyone has certainly identified what you're talking about, this sort of hegemony of the high school or elementary school textbook and the horrible blandness of so many of those textbooks. And they see some of this new technology as a way of whether supplementing it or perhaps supplanting it in some cases. I mean, California is not going to give up its textbook adoption machine, but Vermont might at some point loosen up and allow for, you know, more digital type of teaching resources in lieu of textbooks. But in any case, they see the ability to use this type of technology as one of the ways that they're going to essentially topple that hegemony. So the question is then, you know, what's standing in their way? I mean, if you really were able to start getting off the ground a legitimate peer-produced system that had access to the kind of third-party content it would need to have to be successful, that might actually be the root of attack against some of this textbook hegemony, as they call it. But the problem is that they've run into the exact sorts of copyright and other problems with being able to... You can't make a textbook for grammar school or high school students without using a lot of third-party content. And so they run into difficulties, licensing difficulties and other problems quickly, in even producing the sort of alternative to the textbook.
Yeah, interestingly, there's a high school out in Arizona, and I forget the name of the high school, but I've done some research on it, where they've scrapped textbooks altogether. They don't use digital textbooks, they don't use physical textbooks, they give every student a laptop, and they force teachers to go ahead and create their own teaching materials. So services like the one Genevieve characterized in her case study would be immensely useful to these teachers. But as it stands right now, and this school has been up and running and seems to be going all right, teachers and students are forced to create materials basically from what they find on the web and use it. And the system seems to be at least moderately successful in Arizona. But part of the reason they undertook this project was precisely to attack the textbook homogeny that's been created by California, Texas, and Florida.
Just factually, you should be aware that there I guess it's now almost 3 years ago, there was an effort to launch California Open Access,
right.
Open Textbook Initiative. It's languishing.
Yeah.
And again, my point was not this is the right way,
sure.
You're doing it wrong. My point is this slice then reflects back on the way in which all of these things you're talking about plays out, and the solution of commons-based production of various forms, workarounds, is differently easy or hard depending on whether you're in one or the other of these systems, and your addressees for regulatory reform are different depending on whether you're in one or the other. The politics of universities are different,
yes,
than the politics of state education boards, and the if you're actually trying to create a map for strategies of intervention, it's useful to map out the different problems and the different,
right,
solutions.
Not to conflate them, that's certainly an excellent point.
So I agree with all that. One other theme, equally general, that happens to connect up with this particular theme is that, as you might have expected if you applied to this problem a general law and society framework, there are patterns of custom that in each subdivision that deviate radically from what you might expect from the legal rules or the top-down governance structures. So an example would be in Jackie's case study on DVD use by film studies professors, Bill summarized the legal prohibitions. Virtually none of the film studies professors abide by them. All right, that's relatively small scale, although it's illustrative. Another example is my older daughter is a public high school history teacher in Massachusetts, and there is no textbook hegemony in Massachusetts public schools. The teachers use an extraordinary variety of materials. In fact, she doesn't use a textbook at all. And she violates the copyright statute like crazy. It's just, it's all through the public school system.
Once you've exposed her in promises to keep
Yeah, that was my younger daughter, right? She was a little irritated about it. So, well, that actually presents, you know, this isn't our central discussion here, but it is a little bit tricky, this an issue that arose. Jackie drafted this article, got published in the Media Studies Journal. There's a little bit of ethical difficulty in bringing to light a functioning custom, plainly unlawful, that's doing a decent job and solving a social problem.
We've encountered it at least half a dozen times.
Is it less politically acceptable to sue teachers than grandmothers? Is that...
Interesting. Well, the grandmothers you were referring to, the peer-to-peer suits, they weren't deliberately targeted. They just happened to turn up in the random suits. And so if the question were actually posed, would you rather run over the grandmother than the teacher, I suppose the answer would be no. But if you know you're running over a teacher, usually you don't bring suits against them. And you bring suits against Kinko's. Or you might bring suits against the University of Massachusetts, but you're not going to bring a suit against Jesse Fisher. It would be hopeless. So custom is really important here as a descriptive matter, and then figuring out how any of these reforms dovetail with the emergence of these structures, which is create a dimension of the ecology radically different from the law, is hard.
Can I ask in the solutions area?
We don't call them solutions yet, but yes, I know what you mean.
Let's try to make a little progress. How about that? By the way, I have to say, California legislature is as in bed with Hollywood as the federal legislature. It's not, ain't going to happen there. You talk about couple of tools, the iCommons and H2O. And I don't know much about them. I'm getting ready to work on some online courseware module type things for things I'm doing. How easy are these things to use? They're not going to get adopted unless they're dead easy for people who are not geeks.
Right.
And what's the state of the art of this stuff? Is it good, bad? I just don't know.
You want to take that? It varies.
I think it varies. I think that in the example of iCommons, from what I know about it, which is not enough, I'm still exploring it, it's not any more difficult for teachers to use than the competing course management tools. So in that regard, and those tools are set up to use menus and make it very easy for teachers to upload things and set access restrictions. So I think the problem there is actually more of an institutional bias. iCommons was created in-house. It's not a major commercial venture as far as I know. So it's one of those things where once these tools become available and prove themselves in the marketplace, which will probably take a period of years, then adoption will be likely. But as it stands right now, they're smallish and probably... many institutions would consider them risky. It's very comforting to say, oh, well, I know Yale Law School and 18 other places use Blackboard, so I'm going to use Blackboard too, as opposed to iCommons, which is just here as far as I know.
Blackboard and some other proprietary systems that are, you know, relatively speaking, pretty user-friendly, not requiring geekitude to use them. But their, you know, openness is not a part of their mission at all. So... you do have the danger that the system that is attractive because it is easy and commercially marketed doesn't have some of the openness attributes that we're looking for in a system like that.
Just one comment. So Hal Roberts did a lot of research in developing H2O on Blackboard, WebCT, and the other sort of offerings out there. Basically found that these guys have the entire market. There's nothing else that competes, and it's not about what you choose. It's about what your institution gives you.
Right.
So it's very much, you know, and it's sort of the default. It's kind of the ignorance. It's what's provided for us. It must be okay. I think it's just a complete lack of understanding and some sort of, you know, analog to we buy in bulk.
But it is the case, you know, that we shifted, Harvard Law School shifted to iCommons last year on our recommendation here, partly in order to start breaking the grip. Now, we've got a little grumping from some of the faculty who, for whom it's not as simple. It's not as user-friendly. It's much more flexible, and it has many more openness options in it, but it's not as smooth.
Can it be used, for example, for a course I'll teach at Berkeley in the fall?
Not currently, no. Yeah,
there's a drawback.
The other comment I'd add to this subject too is, I mean, as other tools completely separate from this, as wikis and blogs and other things become more widespread and at least in principle easier to use, you know, you do have teachers will have the option to just take things that are not customized for the educational space and use them for that purpose, and we're already seeing that. You know, class blogs at high schools and stuff are using MySpace as a teaching tool. Second Life. I mean, all kinds of things are happening. Some of them are pretty user-friendly because they're commercial products like Blogger that are not educationally oriented, but they can be used for that way.
But at the same time, there's some risk that institutions might actually crack down on the use of tools like wikis and blogs if they feel like, Harvard used to have a strict policy of kind of locking its content in, and that seems to be changing with the efforts of people like Terry. But I remember John Zittrain sitting in our cyber law class and talking about how a few years ago he had wanted to make the class all available online to the entire universe, and the school said no. And the reason they gave was that Harvard is Harvard and we want to maintain exclusivity. So there's a risk that institutions that maintain that attitude might not let their educators use these important tools.
Just a quick question. In terms of delineating educators' intentions, it seems like those educators that might not be in the position of authoring a textbook or might not be in a position of writing a paper that would necessarily be distributed by a large publishing house, that many of these tools actually offer them personal incentive to more widely distribute their work, like that cost incentive. And I was just wondering, I couldn't remember the slide that lists people's intentions, but it does seem like when you speak about educators, it's easy to think about various types of educators, like not just those who are at the university level or those who are at the high school level, but what varying intentions they would have for using these tools. For some of them, it might just be a wider means of distribution that they wouldn't have access to. For others, it might be explicitly sharing. For others, it might be reducing the cost in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so I can see how those different intentions would push them to offer different choices, much more so than just, because I don't just think it's the educator saying no to the textbook, even though that's implicitly what you use.
Absolutely, and I think that just circles back to what we said towards the beginning of the Q&A session about the different incentives that people have when they're sort of creating content and putting it out into this educational space. You know, they can be motivated by a whole panoply of incentives, and which incentives those are is going to have a huge impact on what kinds of openness you can then expect them to welcome.
And so what motivates most of the people who are sort of bucking the trend? Like in the case of the school, it seems like they're responding to textbook hegemony. But in most other cases, why is it that many educators are pushing back, and why are they choosing these tools?
I certainly can't rank them as for what's the most and the second and the third, but I can tell you some things that we've heard from folks. One, you engage your students better if you use the kind of media-rich, technological type of content that they've become accustomed to in their lives. And that's true at all levels of education, I think. Two, and this probably is the case for Terry's daughter, you want to teach what you want to teach, not what the author of the textbook has told you to teach, and so you go out and put together something that's relatively customized to what you wanted to, you thought was important to teach your students. And then a third, and this is not at all an exhaustive list, is I think some people are, it's particularly like the Red Hot Jazz Archive kind of example. I mean, some people are, excited about their particular interest and want to share it with the world. I think a lot of Wikipedians are that way. And that's a third kind of motivation. And a fourth, by the way, you know, there are some high school teachers who, or college teachers who participate in writing textbooks and make a not terrible amount of royalties. And it's part of their income.
In line with people who, oh, sorry, I'm SJ, by the way. And in line of what you just said, the people who like to produce content, one of the courses of action which isn't legal in any sense, is finding methods of production which are positive for the contributors. And it may or may not be the case that most of the content that we use could be reached by some path, each step along the way of which is positive for the people contributing to it, so that they really enjoy doing it. They don't need some elaborate external system of law and transaction processing to make them happy with it. And I would be very excited if someone identified what the subsets of educational materials were which could be satisfied that way, mm-hmm. and try to at least carve out that niche.
Right. This is probably a good time to insert a comment, too. There's one sort of dichotomy in this entire project. There's production of content, and then there's people who are using content, who are pulling it into what they're doing. And they're different questions, you know, and they raise very distinct problems. We're mostly trying to focus on the second, on what about people who want to use content, integrate content into what they're doing educationally, as opposed to analyzing, you know, open access and, you know, producing educational content in a way that is less encumbered by copyright restrictions. But they're, I think that's essentially what you're pointing out. They're absolutely, you know, two sides of the same coin. And so it becomes difficult to, they're distinct problems, but it becomes difficult to talk about one and not look at the other. But for sure, the more content gets created in under, say, a Creative Commons license, you know, the less we're going to have to sort of, you know, worry and keen about people's ability to use content educationally, because there will be more, you know, I mean, if there were more pod-safe music, we would be, you know, podcasters wouldn't have such trouble. If there's more ed-safe content, educators will have less trouble. But I can't imagine a scenario in which all content educators could want to use would be ed-safe in that way, because educators want to use all content. They might want to use a still. This is my example. You know, the sociologist who wants to talk about the impact of Britney Spears on feminism. You know, she wants to use stills from Britney Spears videos. That ain't never going to be produced in an open access, you know, manner. So there's always going to be some residual problem of educators wanting access to content that is not Creative Commons content.
Did you find any indication of people designing their courses so as to avoid these problems? For example, teaching art history up to 1920?
I've heard anecdotal stories to that effect. We haven't done it. We haven't looked at them in a rigorous way. I don't know if either of you has something else to say. And I mean, I suppose actually, our case study is a little bit that way. The Center for History and New Media is going to launch its social networking site for high school teachers, and it's going to have a component where teachers can share teaching resources. But it's going to say, but none of them should have any copyrighted material at the upload point. You know what Wikipedia does essentially, and. You know, they haven't launched it yet, so it would be interesting to see once it goes up. But it would be interesting to see, does that then prejudice a lot of what resources get put up there? Do we have all kinds of Civil War content and nothing about the Vietnam conflict for that reason? Once they launch, I guess we'll get to find out.
I would be very surprised, however, to return to the earlier theme of people abided by that. I think it's a self-protective fig leaf on the part of the organizers. I think it's unlikely that the teachers are going to respect it.
Right.
Well, there's something that came up as you were talking about Blackboard and iCommons. To what extent does iCommons give the instructor the option to segregate some material from the world? It does.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, the more you're open to the world, the more constrained you are in honoring the law and the breach, and vice versa. So the option of putting out the syllabus and the public domain materials or the permission materials in the open, and then having a closed system that partly is about not avoiding detection, partly is just about lowering the impact and therefore improving the fair use claim that it really is in an educational context that you are actually controlling. That ends up, I think, being an important component.
I think that's right. So what's the implication of it?
Yeah, that's because I never actually signed. They don't. When they say copyright 98 Elsevier, it's actually contestable.
It seemed unlikely.
It's contestable.
Yeah.
I was sufficiently junior at the time that I didn't take the stance that I've been taking since 2000, which is nobody gets to publish it
right.
unless I get to reserve the rights to give it
right.
up. But it's a complicated story. It's highly contestable.
I didn't mean to do
that.
That
copyright notice they have right. is in fact descriptive of the state of the rights.
Derek and Tim are in the room kind of heaving a sigh of relief. Right?
We have time.
Yeah.
I'd like to stop at quarter time. The other thing that we look at, obviously, is the changing kind of landscape of academia itself. And did you, as part of this, look at the emergence of for-profit schools, the emergence of, especially in management education, there are corporate trainers that kind of definitely fall into that gray area that are making a lot of money. And oftentimes, you know, for instance, in terms of Harvard Business School content, they're making a lot of money because they're going to the table with Harvard Business School materials with that name. And how does this all play out in that sphere?
My sense is that's a great question. No, but it's just
yeah.
a dimensional problem we haven't looked at.
That's a really good question. And it does. I mean, there's this sort of tendency, sloppy tendency, and you see it in the case law as well, to conflate the commerciality or non-commerciality with the activity with sort of educational. And in a lot of ways, that's not always so clear that those two always overlap. And your example is probably the clearest yet, where you have, you know, avowedly commercial education. But, you know, it becomes a very complicated question, and it makes the line drawing for what's educational in terms of what we should be protecting with our special copyright rules very complicated. One more, you want to stop?
I was going to make a comment that I wanted to say this before I forgot, that I was part of one of the few lucky people in this room who participated in your initial day in November. And I think where you guys come is awesome. So I really am very impressed with the layout so far, and I'm excited to see your paper.
That seems
kind of
nice.
Yeah. Well, it's really been fun to work on. And one of the things that's been fun about this project, I'll say, in the spirit of the Berkman Center generally, is it's been such a collaborative project. It's been wonderful to work with Terry, who everything Colin said about him is true. And then, you know, quite, you know, Susie helped us at different stages. Many students, both JDs and Harvard Law School graduate students, have been deeply involved with segments of it, and Jackie as a particular, you know, first among equals and of that type. So it's been a great experience in that respect, and you know, hopefully a model for the way projects run around here. It's something that, you know, frequently is the way Berkman projects run, and it's been a great aspect of it for me.
So thanks everybody for coming.